There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to The Inspired Evolution. I'm your humble host, Amrit Sandhu, and you're tuning in to a conscious conversation designed to help you grow. Our mission here is simple. It's for you to live your purpose, live your best life, live the life you love. This podcast is sponsored by Enthusiasm for Life, by Great Creation itself. To keep the good vibes flowing for myself and yourself, do us a solid, subscribe to the Inspired Evolution podcast on YouTube, the home of the Inspired Evolution podcast. Now sit back, relax, open your mind, open your heart to this conversation, and stay inspired. Keep evolving. Welcome to the Inspired Evolution. And it is such a treat to be here today. We have with us Dr. Ronald Siegel. Ron, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. For those tuning into Ron for the first time, he is Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School, Assistant Professor, where he has taught for multiple decades, over 35 years. And he's a long-term student of mindfulness meditation. He serves on the board of directors in the faculty of the Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy. He's written some really incredible books. Mindfulness and its ability to heal. The recent book is The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary. Now, I love the title of this book, and I wanted to really dive deeper into this space, if that was okay, Ron, today. What prompted you to write a book on ordinariness? Because it doesn't seem to be the most, looking at the books that you've written on mindfulness, I think there's a real draw card around mindfulness, especially in today's society, the way we're sort of
You know, Stephen Kotler, one of the other guests I've had, you know, researching flow, talks about there's this 20% anxiety sort of baked into the social collective that we currently navigate. And so mindfulness is this real, presents itself as a real antidote. And so following the thread of your past books and then feeling into ordinariness, like this doesn't seem to be kind of what people are seeking out at the moment.
When I was searching for a title, I was doing little focus groups with my friends and colleagues, and one of them wrote back when this title was put forth and said, nobody would buy a book about being ordinary. Everybody wants to be special.
Which yeah. I think is exactly how do you become saying. A New York Times bestseller?
Exactly. Well, that may not be the fate of the book, but rather it may be useful to people instead. The inspiration actually came was very personal. There I was already in my 60s, having spent some four decades with serious investigation of mindfulness practices, personally as well as professionally, and the same number of decades working with clients or patients professionally, having been, of course, in my own therapy as part of my training. And you would think that at the end of all that, I would have gotten what are really the supposed fruits of meditation practices, certainly in the Buddhist traditions from which many mindfulness practices derive. The idea is to not be so self-preoccupied, is to not be, you know, so concerned with ego, with how you look to yourself and to others. And certainly in Western psychology, we see as the goal, you would imagine one would have a stable, coherent sense of self or something called positive self-esteem. And being honest with myself, neither had occurred. You know, that my sense of myself was still fluctuating. I mean, not fluctuating as badly as it does for some people who are stopped in their tracks by it. But, you know, if I were to say what the general tenor was, it was either struggling to avoid feeling not good enough in some way, making sure that I keep up, keep accomplishing things, checking out how I'm doing compared to my peers, or being kind of stressed out, involved in all sorts of productive activities that were designed in part to make me feel good about myself, to make me feel, yeah, I'm a successful human being. And that was occurring in so many realms. And I thought, well, this is interesting. I look at my clinical practice and I realize everybody that I was working with, one dimension of their suffering was either feeling not good enough or being stressed out, trying to stay on top of the heap in some way. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. How come this is persisting? And, you know, one hypothesis was, well, I'm just a loser. You know, here I am. You know, I had trouble with, you know.
Professor at Harvard, written multiple books.
It doesn't matter. I mean, that's one of the fascinating things that we find. It doesn't matter where you are on any continuum that you might invent.
Yeah.
What happens is we suffer from something, I made up a name for it, narcissistic recalibration. There was a time, I don't know if you have this in Australia, where, you know, as a toddler, I figured out how to put multicolored rings, kind of like donuts, on a pole in the right order so that they look like a cone or a Christmas tree.
I was doing that just last night. My son has one of those.
Excellent. Okay. So it exists and it still exists in Australia. And right when your son got it, so it looked like the cone, there's probably a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, we get super excited.
And hey, daddy, look, right? Yeah. And that did once float all of our boats. However, as time goes on, we tend to recalibrate and we tend to actually keep raising our standards. So interesting. I often train psychotherapists. It's one of my professional roles. And sometimes I'll be talking about this topic with a significant group of psychotherapists. And I'll say, all of you earn this advanced degree, right? And there was a time when you earned that degree where when you finally graduated, you know, you probably felt pretty good about yourself. And everybody says, yeah, absolutely. And I say, now who woke up this morning feeling, you know, I really feel proud and fulfilled because I have my advanced degree? And the whole group, exactly as you're starts to laugh, right? Except sometimes there's one newly minted psychotherapist who raises their hand and says, why is everybody laughing? Because they're still a watch of the glow. They haven't recalibrated yet. Because what happens as we move through life, no matter what we're doing, we keep changing our peer group, right? And then we start comparing ourselves to others. So, you know, you could take an Olympic gold medalist, right? And, you know, if they don't win the gold, they feel pretty inadequate. Well, for somebody else, I shouldn't say a gold medalist who doesn't win the gold, but somebody competing doesn't win the gold, they feel inadequate. Whereas any other athlete in the whole world would think, oh my gosh, to be able to compete in the Olympics, what I wouldn't do for that.
Yeah.
And then there's another problem. In addition to this recalibration, the way that our measuring stick keeps changing is everything changes. What goes up goes down. So the person who does actually win the gold, what are the chances of winning it in 4 years or in 8 years? So it was really noticing that, oh my gosh, I'm still caught in this. Everybody I'm working with is caught in this. I see it on the world stage. What's up with this? And even more importantly, what might we be able to do about it?
I'd love to tune into what might we be able to do about it. But just before we go all the way in there, I'd love to sort of ask a little bit around what your thoughts on the bedrock of what has brought this to us as human beings might be. Is it somewhat that our evolution has dictated this and built it into kind of our way of being, this idea of comparison, this consistent need to, I guess, feel good about myself relative to my peers and my cohort? Or is it something that is a bit more influenced by society? Is it the way that this capitalistic structure is structured around me that I sort of, well, it doesn't have to just be capitalism, it could be any other culture as well. You sort of see it manifest where there's these social hierarchies and where we're trying to basically put one hand on, you know, climb on one from one rung to the other. And sometimes we're sort of stepping on heads as we're going up. We don't realize we're doing that until we tune in. So yeah, is it a social thing or is it like a biological, like?
I think it's a perfect storm of the social and biological coming together.
Right.
On the biological end, this is baked into social species. They all organize themselves into hierarchies. If you've ever, had the privilege of going on a so-called safari in Africa, which means riding around in a jeep with a naturalist, the observations become somewhat repetitive. In species after species, we see here's a dominant male surrounded by a literal harem of sexually or reproductively promising females. Mm-hmm. And then over in the next field, there's another bunch of guys, usually a bit younger, doing some kind of competitive horseplay, the species-specific equivalent of playing, do you call it football?
basketball.
In Australia. Basketball, whatever. But like honing their skills, right, to try to become dominant. And we look at other species like birds, pecking orders. We use that phrase in English, right? Yeah. Because it represents something. There are even species of crickets that when you put them in a box, inside of a few seconds, they've organized themselves into dominance hierarchies. And little kids as young as age 4, if you put 3 of them in a group, they will organize themselves into what are called, social psychologists love to study this stuff, transitive dominance hierarchies. Transitive is this idea of transitivity. It's what you learned if you took high school algebra, that if A is bigger than B and B is bigger than C, then A is bigger than C.
Yeah.
So if Julio is able to dominate or lord over or boss around Juanita, and Juanita is able to do that to John, John knows he's got to give deference to Julio, right?
Yeah.
And kids figure that out inside of a few minutes of just playing with each other at age 4. So indeed, that part of the equation is very, very strongly baked in. And it makes sense if we look at our evolutionary history. You know, the way that modern biologists understand this is anything that would provide for the survival of an individual and the successful reproduction of an individual, and then the passing on of those genes to subsequent generations, that's what's going to get selected for. Anything that doesn't help with that, well, in the random play of mutations and stuff, that's going to fall away. It's not going to be part of how, in this case, our brains evolved. So we might imagine that there were, happy hominids 4 million years ago, hang around who didn't have these comparative concerns.
Yeah, the kumbaya.
Exactly. Holding hands, singing kumbaya, and you know, just cooperating. And we do have an instinct for cooperation, but by and large, those who didn't compete in this way, they didn't get to reproduce as much. And as a result, their genes kind of filtered out of our gene pool. And what got reinforced over and over and over was this preoccupation. And what happens in humans is we're not necessarily physically beating our chests and pounding each other over the head, although there are circumstances in which we do that too. But we're not necessarily doing that, but we're having these fluctuating self-esteem experiences. Mm. We're having these moments when we're with other people where we're feeling, hey, I'm doing pretty well. You know, I'm kind of smart, or hey, I'm attractive, or I'm funny, or people like me, or I'm kind, or I'm spiritually advanced. We can do this with anything.
Yeah. And, you know, insidious one. No one.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, compared to other people and other moments where we're feeling exactly the opposite, where we're feeling somehow not good enough. Oh, I'm not the kind of person I want to be. Gosh, I'm not so talented. I'm not so spiritually advanced. I'm a mess. I'm, you know, I'm not a good friend. And it's these constantly fluctuating evaluations that actually draw their juice in part from the fact that we're simply deeply wired as mammals, social mammals, to be concerned with comparisons. And because we're sophisticated, these comparisons are, you know, can be very subtle and symbolic and take on all sorts of dimensions. But you also mentioned something super important, which is that because this biology is so strong, we've organized societies based on it. Mm. So virtually every human society is deeply hierarchical. And in fact, when we look at the attempts to not be hierarchical, let's take socialist societies around the globe. And I'm not going to argue, you know, have a left-right argument here, although I have my biases, but I don't think they're important to the argument. Mm. You know, we've certainly seen that ostensibly socialist states are organized with, well, party members are certainly higher in the hierarchy than the non-party members. And, you know, other kinds of hierarchies start to develop. So it happens in human societies. And then this, which has happened throughout history, has gotten an enormous steroid boost in just the last few years with social media. Because now we have the ability all day long to compare ourselves to others. I don't know about you, but I don't see a lot of social media feeds. I mean, I don't actually see a lot of social media feeds, period. Yeah. But from what I know, not that many people post, say, woke up this morning, had the runs again. I'm afraid I'm
burnt my eggs.
Bad performance. Exactly, bad performance review. And my girlfriend or boyfriend is going to leave me. No, it's like, here I am at a fantastic place, doing fantastic things with beautiful people, and you're not included. So... Mm. You know, and it was Mark Zuckerberg, you know, who founded Facebook. It was his absolute genius to realize that people will stay glued to your platform if you let them get likes, if you offer the opportunity for them to get followers, if you give the people this potential. And, you know, psychologists who wire people up.
Pseudo-human connection,
Absolutely, absolutely. And they put people in scanners, and every time they get a like, the nucleus accumbens, the part of the brain that's in the reward center, it goes crazy, it lights up. So we get super addicted to it by our hierarchical cultural structures and now amplified by social media. So the answer to your question is, yeah, both and this is one of the reasons it's we find this happening so strongly in almost all of us.
And so at the risk of picking a low-hanging fruit there, was that partially some of the impetus to write this book now?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That it's not getting better, it's getting worse. In fact, I'll just give you a brief research piece. There's an instrument that's used by social psychologists called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory. Mm-hmm. And it asks people, usually kids entering university, to just say, which of these two statements is more true? And the statements will be something like, I just want to be a reasonably happy person versus I want to amount to something in the world. Or my favorite choice that they give them is, if I ran the world, it would be a better place.
Surely it would be though. No.
person, the thought of running the world scares the hell out of me, right? And you know, and they've been tracking like kids' response to this, and they just get more and more like, I got to be an internet influencer. I got to, you know, start a dot-com company by the time I'm 30. Yeah, no, this is amping up tremendously. And yeah, it was one of the inspirations.
Yeah, and the pressure around all of that. So one of the things that tuning into your work has been somewhat revolutionary for me in a very subtle way was for a while there, I was demonizing narcissism as a thing that just, you know, I have definitely, you know, had narcissistic tendencies in the past. And then, you know, we talk about narcissistic recalibration, and maybe this is not the, you know, exact sort of ideologies that you embody around narcissistic recalibration, but I found over time, especially through greater and greater levels of self-awareness, my relationship with my obsession with self shifted. And so, you know, it's healed in a great deal. But I've digressed somewhat to the point that I was trying to make, which was this conversation around narcissistic supply, which I found a really interesting concept to discuss, because it basically alludes to, and I probably shouldn't put words in your mouth, but that there is some amount of narcissism that is healthy for our existence and our individual expression, yet left unchecked, there are problems. Can you describe a little bit around what I'm talking about here?
You're raising an excellent question, and because it really tunes us into what's a very subtle matter. We definitely know that having what we would think of as low self-esteem isn't very helpful. In other words, thinking everybody else is better than me, I'm no good, nobody's interested in me, the you know, the proverbial Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh, if you will. You know, clearly that's not that's not a great stance to have in life. And oh gosh, so many people are struggling with that, you know, really feel like less than most of the time. And that is deeply painful. Having a realistic sense of our abilities sure is helpful. Like, right, if I know, I'm a psychologist, I can reasonably work with this or that, you know, client or patient, but nope, my understanding of anatomy is such that I should not be given a scalpel to be a brain surgeon. That is definitely not something I know about, you know. I can't.
A healthy level of self-awareness.
Right, so, you know, now is that narcissism to feel like I have certain competencies, or is it simply awareness of this is where skills lie, this is where skills don't lie? I would actually suggest, and this is a little bit countercultural, more than a little countercultural, that no, we don't actually need any narcissism in the sense of we don't actually need to think that we're better than others in any realm. What we do need is a profound sense of self-acceptance and self-compassion. We do need to sense that we are fundamentally lovable, we fundamentally have value in the world, and we are connected to others. But all those things can happen without any self-evaluation, because this is about feeling acceptance, feeling connection, feeling engagement that's not based on the mythology that one person can be better or worse than another fundamentally. Yes, one may have skills where another doesn't have skills. One's taller, one's shorter. That's all obvious and sometimes quite necessary. You want the taller person to reach to the top shelf, right? Not the shorter person. They're going to get, they're going to be able to do it. So practically speaking, really important. But in terms of how it feels, I'm not sure we need narcissistic supplies. That may be an idea baked into Western psychology that comes from the fact that Western psychology never really examined very deeply, not all of it, but mainstream Western psychology never really deeply examined this whole idea of how is self constructed and what elements of that are basically illusory.
Wow. Yeah. I think it's really interesting to feel into the depth of acceptance that is required to sort of let go of that level of self. In the way you've, or the way I'm picking off the response that you've just given and taking off from there, it feels like this is a very spiritual sort of ordinariness that you're sort of working your way towards, because there is a, I don't want to say transcendence of the ego, but a separate, I don't, not even a separation from self. It's almost like a sinking into a self that isn't linking into that illusory sense of self, to sort of just accept on this level of, okay, here I am, and this is what I'm about, and this is where I'm at. This is me here now in many ways. Am I landing in the right place?
I think you're landing very much in, I don't know if it's right. We may both be deluded. You're landing in the same.
Well, the places that you're pointing to.
you are landing in the way that, you know, describing well, my understanding, the best that I have. And I don't want to set this, you know, in describing this, you know, this is describing a light, if you will, that we might want to orient toward.
I
don't experience in my own life a great number of more than moments in which this kind of comparative judgment doesn't arise. I don't see it in the lives of other people. The forces, we're just hardwired for it. You know, in the same way, I like this as an analogy sometimes. Virtually every culture that I've ever had the privilege of touching on or traveling to has some kind of delicacy, which is basically fatty and sweet, right? The equivalent of the American donut, right? Uh-huh. And I think there's a reason for that, because in historical long ago times, you know, fat and sugar signaled calories, and we, you know, getting calories was like the main thing that organisms needed, and so we evolved to like that. Now, what most people in the developed world learn is, just going with that instinct doesn't work out well in the long run, right? You know, we don't feel good. Well, I mean, I'm not against eating donuts, but we don't feel good if we make that the mainstay of our diet. You know, it doesn't work well for us. So, in the same way, these instincts towards social comparison, trying to feel good about ourselves, they're not going away the same way my love of donuts isn't going away. But if I put most of my energies into, okay, so it's as though I were guiding my nutritional life and thinking, how can I set it up so I have nonstop donuts? That's kind of what we do about our sense of self. How can I make it so I'm a winner? How can I make it so that people always like me? How can I make it so that I feel successful all the time? In fact, we have a mythology, a crazy mythology, at least in American culture, you tell me if this is in Australian culture, that only losers are insecure about self-esteem. Only losers have these fluctuations in, you know, in feeling. In fact, we recently had a president who would state that all the time. You know, look. He choked. He looked nervous there. He's an inferior, lower ranking primate. You know, I didn't quite use that language, but that was
to the effect of,
you know, that was what was implied. So, I think we're all going to, I'm expecting this to be a lifelong struggle for me. And by pointing my energies in a certain direction, I can make it so I'm not doubling down on this instinct. I'm not reinforcing it, but rather I'm cultivating some other instincts and other ways of being in the world that aren't subject to the same shortfalls, that aren't in necessarily limited supply, where it's not like I win and you lose, and that are actually more more sustainable and feel more deeply meaningful. And absolutely, they lie in a spiritual direction. They lie in a direction of feeling connected to other people, life, the planet, connected to things outside of ourselves, and less preoccupied with narratives about ourselves and how I look and how I seem and what everybody's thinking about me.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I have a very affinity for the response I feel I'm going to get from this space already, because I'm exposed to your work. But for me, a lot of the question that I want to ask is for the listener and the audience and myself to tune into, what does that look like in your own life? The sort of orientation and what you're, the sense of what you're cultivating, part of me knows that a deep sense of service is embedded in there. But please don't let me pre-frame it, which I've accidentally already done. But yeah, please tell me, what does that look like for yourself?
You know, it's a... it's a daily practice. I'll give you a real life example of something that happened recently. Okay. So I've been in a kind of a mentor role in a program that's training clinicians in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy.
Yeah.
And in any event, working with this group, I missed some things early on. In other words, some people shared some vulnerabilities and I didn't pick up on it. And in fact, I had a somewhat different expectation of my role than did some of the members. So I kind of got into my little bit professorial role that I'm familiar with and I know how to do. And I wasn't really connecting, but I didn't really know why. And I didn't have the wisdom at that moment to say something's not really connecting. Let's understand this. And I, a little bit later, you know, over the course of our work together, some people spoke up. And, you know, it was painful to hear. I'm a psychologist, I'm a teacher. You know, you'd think I'd be able to communicate with people and create an atmosphere that felt safe. That's not what was happening. It was feeling unsafe to several people. And, you know, that was heartbreaking. Now, how am I going to respond to that? There is a part of me that responded with, well, there are reasons why I did what I did. This is the justification that I had. Yeah. You know, I didn't know about this or that. You never spoke up. How was I to know? You know, the sort of self-defense, you know, constructing a narrative so that Ron doesn't have to feel he failed at this. Right. And that's along the self-esteem dimension, that kind of thing. And then there's the possibility of saying, what if that didn't matter? What if this really wasn't about whether you're a good group leader or not, whether you're successful or not, whether people like you or not? What if this were really about what do these people need right now? How can you best serve them? And to do that meant to just really try to listen, really try to hear them. And share, not to make it be too much about me, but share how heartbreaking it is to me to have blown it in this way. And interestingly, it's a very good group of people. You know, I think that mattered. You know, that started to shift the whole dynamic, right? They started saying, oh, you know, he's not some jerk professor from Harvard. He's a human being who missed it, right? I am a human being who missed it. That's a little bit, I'm sharing this with you just because it just happened a couple of days ago.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. It's you know, that's really
a kind
helpful.
Of real world example of what this feels like. And then it becomes a whole doorway into understanding things like, okay, how is it that, you know, that I got hooked on, you know, being sort of, you know, intellectually skilled as a way to feel okay in the world. And yeah, you know, for me, it doesn't take deep introspection. It's like absolute compensation for all the things I wasn't good at. I was not a good athlete as a kid. My dad, who was an intellectual, used to say, I'm so sorry, Ronnie, I can't really show you how to throw a ball well. I don't know how to do it, you know? And he was kind of okay with that, but it didn't work out well for me, you know, so well in elementary school. And then, you know, starting to notice the way that, you know, trying to be smart or articulate or something, you know, is compensatory to that, you know, starts unraveling these whole threads of how we lean on certain qualities and abilities to compensate for the pain of not being so good at other things. And also how we develop, you know, so many little traumas throughout our lives of the times that we failed, the times that we felt rejected, the times we felt not good enough. And because often they happen originally when we were young and it was too much to bear, we sort of turn our attention away from it or we double down on our strengths. As one of my patients put it so eloquently, yeah, when we bury feelings, we bury them alive, don't we? You know, they don't really go away. So then a new situation comes up where we're a little bit threatened or we're not doing so well. And it resonates with all those old feelings. And then we're really reactive and really having difficulty. So kind of a way to work with this is to just be aware, okay, this whole business of trying to build myself up in my own eyes or in the eyes of others fundamentally isn't going to be a good pathway to well-being, the same way donuts aren't going to do it for me in the long run. I'm not saying don't enjoy the donut. I'm not saying that if somebody tells you that you have a wonderful podcast and they've been deeply moved by your work, don't enjoy the good feeling of having done something well. That's part of the mix. But how can we not orient ourselves mostly toward hanging on to that? And how can we...
As the source of my wellspring, of my goodness in life, and as my identity for being a good human.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, there's a moment in the meeting with the students where, you know, I just felt so sad about having blown it. And there was a realization that this was absolutely right. I had no idea how it was going to go forward in the group or how they'd react. I mean, you know, there are other human beings. They have their own needs and rights and... We'll see what happens, but where it felt so right to not be defending me and not being concerned with that in that moment, but to just be vulnerable to the ordinariness of being a human being who makes mistakes like other human beings make mistakes.
Wow. The actual work that it takes to be ordinary, I can really
buy the book.
It's almost easier just to try and be extraordinary.
Buy the book on being the winner and the best kid in the on the block and all that. You know, might be easier. No, this is a hard path, but I don't know. Signal after signal tells me, you know, it's ultimately a more fulfilling path for us all, and it's better for us getting along with each other, and ultimately better for the planet.
And yes, because I do want to. I have to ask this question in this podcast, which is, what do we say to that individual? Because I often, and you know, let's speak to that part of me, even just, you know, not even listener tuning in. There is a part of me that is addicted to the strive. You know, it's, I can accomplish things, and what more can I accomplish? You know, and you know, how much more can we, you know, get this to resonate? You know, and this is a really important conversation. Even this conversation you and I are having, you know, there's a part of me that's like, I want to get this to as many people as possible so that it then alleviates their stress around striving. And it's like, that's a strive, bro. You
know? Well, so much has to do with the balance of motivations. And we can't be pure about this, but I was talking about this. I was having a conversation with my friend Rick Hansen, who's a really smart, really deep, really wise psychologist. He wrote The Buddha's Brain and other things, and well known in America. And I say, oh, my book's coming out, and I'm so torn because I really do believe this message can be useful to people, and. If I could even help a few other people to avoid some of the lifelong suffering I've had barking up the wrong tree here, that would really feel meaningful. But, you know, when I think of marketing something that I've done, I think, well, chewing glass, marketing, which would be more fun, you know? Because, you know, getting out there and trying and say, please recognize me and please be interested in me, I hate it. I hate it in part because I hate the crashes, right? I hate, you know, I hate the times where there's disappointment and I narcissistically recalibrate, you know? Mm. Oh, no podcast interview in the last week, you know? I'm now a failure, the scale keeps changing. So I think it's about, and what Rick said very wisely, is he said, you know, you gotta, you know, stay focused on your values here. Stay focused on what matters. If you're reaching out to people to let the world know about this book, because mostly because it's never going to be pure, but mostly because you genuinely want to be helpful in the same way that, as I just heard it when you were talking about the work that you're doing, it sounded like genuinely wanting to be helpful, even though, yep, there's probably going to be a self-esteem boost if more people sign up for the podcast than if fewer people
Absolutely.
For the podcast. I mean, unless you're really advanced on this spiritual path.
Still working.
You're still working, right? Me too. So it's still going to happen. So how can we let it happen? How can we have the courage to work with the disappointments? Because every one of those disappointments is going to be an opportunity to look at our delusions every time that I feel, you know, unrecognized professionally, or like, oh, people didn't like my work, or somebody didn't like a podcast interview I did or something like that, you know, if I really examine, so what's that pain? Oh, it's going to connect to every girlfriend that ever broke up with me. It's going to connect with every time I ever failed a test, every time I was, you know, was hopeless on the athletic field. It's really a string of these injuries. And actually, the current injury can be a doorway in to healing and working with the past injuries. And looking at it that way can give us the courage to do that, as we mostly turn our attention to, can I do striving, but striving not to aggrandize Ron, not to save Ron from feelings of inadequacy, but to try to accomplish something that's in line with our values.
Part of me just wants to end the podcast. We're nowhere near the end. That was huge. It's the aggrandizing of self that is somewhat problematic. And I think even just the way we idolize stars and influencers, and, you know, I think therein we've circled back to the cultural piece. But one of the, as you were speaking, there was this thing that happened for me recently that just has reared its head, and I wanted to share it in this space, if that's okay. I remember I was, we were at a meditation retreat, and I was sharing a piece of music that I had written, and I've been on quite the journey to sort of bring my skills on the guitar along with the skills of the voice. And long story short, I shared this piece, and a musician that I respect and has actually been my teacher in many ways turned around and was like really just gave me like the thumbs up, like, you know, that was something. And like what that, like inside I was just like, what? Like, this person is like, I idolize this person in many ways when it comes to, you know, their relationship with music, and it was a lot for me to receive that, and I felt, you know, I was buoyed is a very easy way to put it, for, you know, an extended period of time. And that the whole day, actually. The very next day, I went to do something on the guitar, and the exact same individual was like, no. And I was like, what? And I was like, no. And I was like, whoa. And the realization, and, you know, the benefits of these retreats, these meditation retreats you go away on, is because, you know, because it's such like a microcosm of self-awareness that you're embodying for this extended period of time, I was hyper aware of the fact that, in fact, the day before, letting that individual's, and this is, that individual's amazing, they're just walking their path, yeah, doing their thing, this is not about them, whether they did the right thing or the wrong thing. But for me, the realization that letting in that praise was also what opened the door to letting the kind of the rejection sort of hurt so much.
Absolutely.
You know, and I was like, whoa, you know, and if it was anybody else, I already had put that, and so, you know, that sort of construct of like self-esteem and my hierarchy and all that. And so the piece that I wanted to sort of dovetail into from there is, what do I do in that instance? Do I hold awareness for my propensities? Do I hold awareness for them and just being aware that this is how I'm gonna, like, you know, this is how society is structured, this is how, you know, the hierarchy is at play, this is how, you know, I place value in things, and this is, and do I accept that to some level? Or is it about sort of, you know, not allowing the good in, because then knowing that that sort of opens up the door for the negative a little bit more? So do I sort of try and find this muted sense of equanimity? How are we navigating this
There are interesting approaches to this. I have a friend and colleague who's a couples therapist named Terry Real here in the United States, and he treats people who have like big narcissism problems, and he teaches them to actually like yank down the buoy when it's going up, right? Exactly what you're saying. Like, you feel like actually yank it down, and when you feel the anchor going, actually yank it up. So that's one strategy. It's not what I'm most drawn toward. I think more, you know, out of my mindfulness practice, I think I'm a little bit more drawn toward the strategy of holding it in open awareness that you were describing, and to just notice, oh my gosh, and to see if we can also allow in a little bit of the cosmic chuckle that gets it. Oh my God, you know, is this really, you know, is this really who this organism is that, you know, this person says we're wonderful and we're Buddha. And it's really, I mean, one of the things I explore in the book and it is really interesting is just to feel what this is like viscerally in the body. You were showing us, right? That, and void as a word, right? Chest comes up, head is higher, we become taller. You know, this is a full psychophysiological experience of, yeah, I've got it. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, you know, I'm on the upswing here with a self-esteem boost. And then when the opposite comes, oh my God, you know, if we were a dog, our tail would be between our legs. We feel the whole body collapses, the pit of the stomach, the whole thing. I mean, this is it. To be a mammal, aware of what this is like, is really intense. Because this stuff is really intense and it's happening all the time. Sometimes not at the magnitude is increased when we're interacting with someone that we value highly, right? You know, this would be less intense if somebody, you know, who you never knew, you know, bumped into you in the street and said, "You jerk," or something. Watch where you're going, right? It wouldn't have the same impact. But we start to see all the variables, and holding it in awareness, we start to see, oh, look how unstable this is. Look at how what goes up goes down, what goes down goes up. And I think bit by bit, I think it's like mindfully eating a donut. If we eat donuts mindfully, we kind of get it after a little while that more than a little.
It's interesting then, isn't it?
It's not so good. And I think when we're really mindful about this stuff, we realize more than a bit of the fluctuation, it's not actually so sustainable. And then I think naturally we become a bit more equanimous. I say a bit because this stuff's not going away the same way the donut interest isn't going away, or I don't think it's going away. I have a good friend who's both a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, and a Zen priest. And, you know, he refers to some of the stories of enlightenment in the Zen tradition as enlightenment pornography. like these airbrush stories
of what of breaking through.
You know, this clear mirror mind. Yeah, I know what moments of that are like, but sustained out there in the world outside of being on retreat, not in this lifetime, not yet. So maybe, but also maybe he's right that it's enlightenment porn. So I don't think it's about holding ourselves up to some standard of expecting equanimity or liberation. Or I think most of that winds up being a spiritual bypass. I think it's really about holding it in awareness. And what I have found since I started writing the book, I'll tell you a little interchange that happened. I kept being late because I kept wanting to research it more and read more things because I got so fascinated by this topic and so engrossed in it. And at one point I wrote to my editor and I said, I was already like a year and a half past deadline. I said, I have some good news and some bad news. And she was very tolerant. I said, the good news is attending to this really is helpful, you know, because since I started writing this book, I'm so conscious of this in myself and in others. And just holding it in awareness like that is loosening it. It's less intense. I'm not believing in these stories as much as I used to. The bad news is I'm going to send back the advance. Who needs to finish another book if I'm not trying to do some work? And she, even though she knows my sense of humor, she didn't know I was kidding. I was mostly kidding, right? And she said, no, I think this is a worthy enterprise. Let's talk, you know? And I do think it's a worthy enterprise, but so this is just to speak to the holding it in awareness that you're mentioning it. Just being aware of this. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is really show how many different domains of our life this operates in, and in how many different areas, you know, from parenting to what we purchase, to the foods we eat, to where and how we travel, to, you know, what we wear. There are so many ways in which these these concerns with how am I going to feel about myself seem to infuse what we're doing. And the more we see it, the freer we become.
And I think I was going to try and allude, like put together a question that was striking towards what, I don't want to use the word evangelize, but what are the benefits that we're evangelizing here of letting go of all of that? And I think you just touched on it there. It's this sense of freedom. For me, tuning into what I felt you were speaking to for me was this deeper sense of peace and acceptance.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting because similar to how you described retreat, like I have moments where everything is just perfect and there is no need to strive. And oftentimes the things that are created from that space are much more wholesome and much more aligned to my integrity. And they actually end up having a greater sense of impact as well, funnily enough, in the world. Whereas when I'm trying to create something because it's what I think may benefit someone else, rather than just from my heart goes, this has helped me, let me share it with you. There's a distinct energetic difference between the two that I've come to realize over time, to the point where I've learned to surrender that more and more often, but I still fall in the trap of actually, this will help this person, let me help them with that. Rather than this has helped me, I wonder if this will help you.
Right.
As a coach, that's been very, very, learning the discernment between the two has been very practical for me in terms of the benefits that it's helped others with as well. The sense of peace and freedom, I think.
Yeah. And a third thing that we haven't yet talked about much, and I know we're nearing the end of our time, but the sense of connection to others, because one of the things that what you were just talking about, that energetic shift, is it really is about celebrating our common humanity, right? This isn't, hey, I'm a coach, I'm a teacher, I'm, you know, whatever, and let me offer my brilliance to you. It's like, oh, wow, we're in this together. You know, let's kind of talk really with each other, maybe even hold hands and discuss, you know, how hard it is to be a human being and what's working for you, what's not working for you, what's working for me, what's not working for me. And, you know, that sense of connection that happens when we're talking with, let's just say, a friend, where it's a friend we can trust. They're not into posturing much. And it's very interesting how contagious this is. You know, when you're with somebody who's kind of concerned with proving themselves, well, that energizes those juices in us, right?
Then we start mirroring that.
We start mirroring it because this is a basic instinct and it can be roused, you know, easily in us. But when we're someone who's not mostly on that channel and we're not mostly on that channel and we're really sharing honestly what it's like to be ordinary, our whole sense of self shifts. And this is actually a step toward what is often seen as non-self or transcending ego or transpersonal experience, because we shift subtly from being a me and a you to feeling like a we. At least I've noticed this at moments during our conversation here together, right? When we're both resonating about something, and the thing that we're resonating about is really something that's about celebrating our shared vulnerability as humans, celebrating our shared difficulty as humans. And when we do that and we become a we, our whole sense of self is different. It's not about me, Ron, it's about us. And that then lets us connect to other people. Also, you know, one of the chapters in the book, a phrase that it's resonated for a lot of people, it continues to resonate to me. What if we went through the world trying to make a connection rather than an impression? How would that feel in each moment? And it's not a bad guideline to have in almost all of our interactions. And it just shifts them a little bit to how do I connect more rather than prove myself more?
I love that, the discernment between connection and impression. Yeah, and and I think even if you dial back the word impression to impress versus connect, And just dialing into what we're doing in that space versus, you know, what am I trying to become to impress someone else? And again, conflating some version of self that is not the authentic version of self. Why is connection so important, Ron?
Because we're social beings. Mm. The same friend who's the Zen priest and the psychiatrist, his name's Bob Waldinger, and he also runs the Harvard Study for Adult Development. And this is the longest standing longitudinal study on well-being. It started in 1938 with some 700 men. It's because Harvard undergraduates were all male back in the 1930s. And it followed this group from the 30s to today. And there, last I checked, there were about 60 of them who are still alive. Mm. And early on, you know, they were checking blood pressure and height and weight, and they were asking them a little bit about how they were doing in their lives. But they got increasingly sophisticated over the decades and would start interviewing their wives or partners and their kids. And they would start doing, you know, lipid profiles and C-reactive protein and all sorts of, you know, inflammation markers, all this stuff. And they would do complex psychological testing. And, you know, Bob, he has a TED talk out about this, says, you know, we're still doing the study, but basically the jury's in. We know what's most important for well-being, and both physical and psychological. And what's most important is the quality of our relationships. And if we feel like we're connected to other human beings in the world, we tend to thrive. If we don't, we tend not to thrive. And I'm not saying you can't get cancer because of a genetic thing or heart disease. You know, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the overarching big variable, it's that. And what I find deeply reassuring, because I come from a New York Jewish background where one of the features of the culture is we argue a lot about stuff. and you don't have to be always harmonious, right? You don't have to, you know, you might bicker sometimes, you might disagree, but the critical variable is feeling like you can trust the other person, like they actually care about you. And if push came to shove, they would try to help. They would try to be there for you. And when we feel in community with one person, with a larger group of people, when we feel that sense of connection, we do better as human beings. And interestingly, the whole positive psychology field, I remember being with Chris Peterson once. He was one of the founders of the whole movement toward studying happiness scientifically. And he sadly died an early death of cancer. But shortly before he died, he said, we know the answer now. It's about other people. Mm-hmm. It's about connecting to other people. So, you know, these disparate lines of investigation come to the same thing. And that's why this is important. That's what we evolved as social beings. We need to be able to connect safely with one another to thrive. And so interestingly, there's a kind of bidirectional relationship between connection, interpersonal connection, and the self-esteem preoccupation stuff. Because when we're trying to aggrandize ourselves, we don't connect so well to people, right?
It's interesting that, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nobody likes somebody who's like always trying to prove themselves, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they may like them like, oh, won't you like me? In other words, they may become a sycophant or a follower or something and hope for a crumb, but they don't really connect to somebody like that. So actually, if we can be more at home with our ordinariness, we can connect more fully to other people. And conversely, when we connect to other people, we don't need the self-esteem stuff. We don't need to prove ourselves because we already feel loved and connected. It's like, no, I'm no good at that. But it's okay because, you know, we're held in love and connection. So there, you know, these two really go hand in hand with one another.
Yeah, I find it really profound because as you're sharing that, I'm drawn back to Tony Robbins's. He's done a lot of work in his life, but one of the pieces that I feel like he pioneered for him, like in this self-improvement space, was the conversation around he believes we have six human needs, and everybody has a different interpretation. I found over time about what we need and what we want, but his six are this need for certainty and uncertainty. So there's a healthy amount of certainty that we need, but if everything was completely certain, you'd be going insane. You need a healthy amount of, you know, like surprise in life as well, for things to go slightly different. So the spice of life is there. But if everything was completely uncertain, you know, then how do you like navigate your way through chaos? You need a healthy amount of order, right? So that order in chaos. And then the next two, he talks about connection and significance, right? And he talks about how, again, you know, there is a bit of a, like at first sight, there isn't a dipole between the two, but actually they are polarities to some degree, which is what you're articulating here as well. I'll just round it off by saying that the last two needs he describes are growth and contribution. He calls them more spiritual needs. And he tries to orient people towards those needs and sort of working their way out from the other four needs. But I think the connection versus significance piece is at, like, obviously at this juncture in the conversation, having spent almost an hour talking about this, it becomes quite apparent. But I think when you start, and even if you just rewind and take a pause and go, okay, like take a moment to think about where we started this conversation, oftentimes one of the reasons why we're driving towards significant, driving to stand out, is so that we will attract someone to us.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
You know, and it's so counterintuitive.
I know.
That it's like it's my so ordinariness that actually connects me back in, not my extraordinariness.
Yeah. I mean, the number of, you know, patients or clients I've seen over the years who were so downtrodden, feeling nobody's ever gonna love me. I'm not extraordinary. You know, I don't have any great talent. And that's gotten so much worse. It's gotten to nobody's going to love me because I don't have a perfect body, or I'm not an internet influencer, or I'm not, you know, I don't have followers. I mean, it, you know, it's just gotten to a level where if you're, where you think that you have to be extraordinary in order to be lovable. And the irony is exactly what you're saying. When we can really connect as ordinary human beings, there's deep love and there's deep trust, and we don't have to be special at all. We can be completely, filled with all sorts of difficulties and flaws and confusions. You know, it's so interesting, you know, having been a psychotherapist for decades, I've had an observation that a lot of people come to therapy hoping that they'll get a whole new personality. You know, the fantasy is, I won't have to be Ron anymore. That yes, it's, I'm so tired of that, anxious at 4 a.m, worrying about this or that. You know, I really want to be like that other person, right? And when therapy goes well, and this is not short-term therapy, longer-term therapy, but when longer-term therapy goes well, the person is very much like they were at the beginning, except they're now friends with that person. They're no longer judging it. They're no longer thinking it's got to be different. They're actually realizing this way that this particular organism evolved is just fine. And you know, Ram Dass, who many people know, started out actually as a Harvard psychologist, as Richard Alpert, and got fired for his LSD experiments, actually psilocybin experiments with Tim Leary. But putting that aside for a moment is interesting story. He used this metaphor. He says, you know, when we go to the woods, and we look at the woods, some trees are tall and straight, some are bent where you can see because of, you know, phototropism, they grew around some kind of obstacle. Some trees are thin, some are thick, some have fallen over and are being decomposed by fungi. And when we look at it, it's all beautiful, right? Even the way the wood, you know, comes into, you know, decomposes and looks a little bit like wood looks in a fire, you know, when it's coming apart with the fungi. That's beautiful, right? The tall trees are beautiful. The bent trees are beautiful. As soon as we move out of the forest and we start interacting with people, oh, they're too fat. Short. Oh, look at the way they're dressed. They're one of those types. They're, you know, the judgment machine.
The beauty disappears and the judgments ensue.
And most of these judgments are designed so that we can feel better about ourselves, right? I'm not no good like that person. I'm good. If we're on the staying ahead stress pole, if we're on the other pole, it's like, oh, they're so beautiful and I'm not, you know, and we can go either way with it. But still, it's the comparative judgments that take over. And this is, you know, what the ordinariness is about is really finding a path that's not mostly about that, but mostly about a very different form of connecting in the world.
And I think at the heart of it, it's finding yourself to be enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ron. Thank you so much for this conversation. It is timely, to say the least. It's also really profound for me to be having this conversation with you as the father of a newborn, and, you know, really deeply recognizing that there is what I say and then there is what I do. And, you know, the behavior that I want to the behaviors that I want to embody, because those are the behaviors that will be modeled by my son. You know, there are certain bodies of work which really, just are sinking in a whole layer deeper than previously that I've noticed now that I've become a father, because they mean that much more. Mm-hmm. And this has definitely been one of them. So I really want to thank you for the work that you're doing in the world. And despite wanting to chew on glass versus marketing, thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Well, this was trying to get you to invite me to join you would be the painful part. Joining you is a sheer delight. And in part because of your insightful questions that so obviously come out of your own work and your own discoveries of what works and doesn't work. And I think virtually anybody who really tries to take an honest look at how their hearts and minds work comes to somewhat similar conclusions. Most of the world's wisdom traditions and religions have come to similar conclusions, because certain strategies, while they come up again and again because they're hardwired, they don't work so well. So I really appreciate your questions and really the your own efforts to orient yourself in a direction that's going to be good, not only for you, not only for your new child, but for the world.
Thank you so much for your blessings. On behalf of myself and the Inspired Evolution audience, we're wishing you all the best on the journey forward. And I just want to say, hey guys, thanks for tuning in. The link to the book is going to be in the show notes below. Please do check it out. It's it's an opportunity to just sink into greater and greater levels of enoughness and your sense of being, and navigating the world with greater levels of peace and freedom. The extraordinary gift of being ordinary, learning to heal your relationship with striving. I'm excited for you guys to tune into that. Thanks again, Ron.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into this amazing episode of The Inspired Evolution. Without you, the Inspired Evolution tribe, this podcast would not be what it is today. Thank you so much for your love and your support. Thank you so much for being so inspired to evolve. It's truly inspiring. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to The Inspired Evolution on YouTube, the home of The Inspired Evolution's video podcast. We release inspiring conversations such as this every week, along with guided meditations and empowering insights, all designed to help you grow and evolve. Honestly, your subscription on YouTube to the channel helps us out a great deal. And one of the other benefits, if you're having any insights or shifts from these episodes that you want to chat about, or if you'd like to leave myself or the guest a message, please do so in the comments on YouTube. I truly look forward to hearing from you. And as always, tribe, remember to stay inspired and keep evolving.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.